It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the Fox News Podcast Network, I'm Dana Perino, and everything will be okay. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Everything Will Be Okay. This week, I'm joined by a financial analyst and the host of Making Money with Charles Payne on the Fox Business Network. Charles is an incredible person. You've probably seen him on Fox News. If you don't know Charles, I'm excited for you to get to listen to him. He has over 30 years of experience reporting on the ebbs and flows of the stock market. He was raised by a single mom. You'll hear this story. His parents divorced when he was about 12. He was the oldest. He had two younger brothers. And Charles really had to dig deep and do a lot to help provide for his family. And ultimately, he found his passion following the latest finance news out of Wall Street and the actual Wall Street Journal. Charles's life and career, it's a true testament to drive, persistence, and faith. And with those three things, you really can achieve incredible dreams, as he has. Let's listen to him here. Charles, a lot of people know you from television, and you're amazing at what you do. But where did it all start? Can you, just to set the stage for this conversation and from where you come from, a person of, one, expertise in what you do, but experience in this issue of education. Take us back. Give us a beginning.
I got to go way back.
Yep.
Okay.
I'm going to make you do that.
Let's go to the childhood, because I think you're right. I think it is important, particularly in my case. So I had two childhoods. And my first childhood was all military bases, army bases. My father was in the army. So I was born in New York. The next brother after me was born in Pittsburgh. The next one was born in Texas. Then we lived in Germany, came back to Pittsburgh, lived in Japan, went to Texas, Alabama, North Carolina, Virginia. And then it was at that point where one day I came home from school and my mom said, "Hey, we're leaving." Her and my father had problems, and so me, my mom, and my two younger brothers all got on a bus. We left Fort Lee, Virginia. We lived in a two-story house, beautiful big lawn, never locked the doors. We had the staircase like the Brady Bunch. Like, it was just so idyllic. It was so beautiful. You go outside, you ride your bike all day. You come home, make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and go back out and ride your bike all day. You know, it was just this amazing life. And all four of us, we left with no money. We got to New York, got to Harlem, which in the 70s, early 70s, the most dangerous, poorest neighborhood in America. You know, the first day, when we got here.
And
was
how old were you?
I was 12.
Okay.
And I was the oldest of the kids. And what was amazing, just to get, first of all, to see the train, right? The subway train was amazing. The Iron Horse. And back then, they still had some really old ones, right? It was truly strap hangers. And then to come out the train station, and here we are in Harlem, and first of all, the energy, Dana, was so amazing. If you've never been around anything like that, music everywhere. Every car that went by had music. People walking around with boom boxes had music. People had speakers in their window had music. And I'm talking music like, I was rocking Elton John, right? Which is cool. You know, Philadelphia Freedom, that kind of stuff. But Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes blew my mind, right? So I'm seeing Double Dutch for the first time. And all of that stuff was absolutely amazing, but then came the other stuff, the hard stuff, right? And the poverty, the anger, the anguish, it's just, you know, we weren't prepared for it. I wasn't prepared for it. You know, we moved all those times, and every time we went to a new place, the house was freshly painted. Every time you turned on the hot water came out. You know, we lived in a room initially. All four of us lived in a room at a friend of my mom, and I guess about a month and a half, 2 months later, we got our own apartment. But that first winter, we barely ever had heat or hot water. It was very rare. So, again, those are things I never, ever, ever experienced. And I never experienced poverty before. I never even knew what it was like to open a cupboard and not see food. You know, and so I was the oldest. And as the oldest, I was thrusted into action. I hadn't thought about money a single day of my life, and that's all I had to think about as trying to help my mom. And initially, I would do things like clean windshields at stoplights. I would buy Windex and paper towels, and I got a job at a bodega. And I guess like anybody else, at a certain age, you start to equate money with Wall Street. And I mean, just, all right, you know, so I go and I start getting the Wall Street Journal. Back then it was so hard to read. If anybody could ever pick up a 1974 Wall Street Journal, it's all lines and numbers. That's all it is. It's crazy. So it took me a few months of reading these journals to sort of start picking up on it. But when I was 14, I told my mom I'm going to work on Wall Street.
And what was her reaction to that? She liked the idea?
She did. She okay. did. She, you know, it was beautiful. We're coming up on the anniversary of her death. Mm-hmm. She was the only one.
Is that right?
She was the only one who.
Because it's risky.
Well, it wasn't about risk. It was about no one believed a black person in my neighborhood. A black person could work on Wall Street.
Good point.
It was about risk. No one cared about risk. Risk is selling drugs. Risk is stealing something and getting shot in the back. There's so much risk. Risk walking out of my door every day and walking over winos and junkies. Mm-hmm. That's risk. That's risk. I face greater risk being an A student in my school and getting beat up for trying to act like a white boy. That's what they called me.
Tell me a little bit about that then.
The daily occurrences?
Yeah, like when you went to school, you're a smart guy. And
it was tough. It was tough because I loved school. Mm-hmm. I really did. And I loved social studies. And, you know, when I was in third grade, we were in Okinawa, Japan. And my teacher used to have two students stand up at the same time, my math teacher. And she would ask a question. Whoever got it right, the other student would have to sit down. I would go through the whole class, bam, knock them all off. So she was moving, and she had me stand up her last day in class, and she says, Charles is the best student I've ever had. So I loved school. And so, you know, I'm going, you know, I'm in school, I'm all eager, and I'm answering questions, and I'm talking to the teacher. And, you know, hey, man, you know, you sound like a white person. Yeah, you think, unfortunately, the kids equated getting an A with being white. And I got beat down for that. I took some serious beatings for that.
And did you have to protect your little brothers as well?
I tried. I wasn't great at it. I'm ashamed to say I wasn't. You know, I was skinny. They were skinny. We were little. It was tough. It was tough. But I had it. I think, you know, in many ways, perhaps I had it a little harder than them, which is good in some ways. But I really did love school. I honestly, growing up in Harlem and growing up in the ghetto, it's tough for parents, right? And it's tough for these for all kids, particularly if you're a kid who wants to excel. And if you can learn the art of hiding to a degree your intelligence. The problem with that, though, when you hide it, no one sees it. Not even teachers who may be able to help you, give you a little bit of extra help. You know, I went to school in Alabama once outside of the military. You know, my father's in Vietnam, and, you know, my mom, we moved to Alabama for a little while. I went to school in Birmingham, and I was like 2 years ahead of everyone. I was like a godsend for the teacher. He was so happy to see me every day. It's like we were talking about Greek mythology all day long. I thought he was going to crack open a beer and just me and him, you know, we talk about it. And same thing when I went to the school in Harlem. I was so far ahead. And I didn't really understand at that particular time, obviously, the ramifications of all of that until later on. And, you know, I never heard of an achievement gap and all that stuff, you know. But it was tough. And it's tough to sort of – to excel in those environments. There's a guy named Jim Clark. I'm not sure if you've heard of him. I don't think anyone really has this distinction of building three separate billion-dollar businesses. So Michael Lewis, I think, wrote a book about him called The New Thing.
Oh, I know the book.
Yeah. So in the book, he follows Jim Clark around and he, you know, shadows him. That's how his style, you know, that's his style of writing. And there's a guy who's always with Jim Clark, a guy from India. So so they want permission. Hey, you know, can we ask him a few questions? So Lewis ends up interviewing this guy. And part of the story that I found so intriguing is he lived in a small village in India. And his sister was like the prettiest girl in the village. And one day he came home from school and she was getting all dolled up. You know, she had a date. So he said, oh, okay. You know, so he asked, you know, who is it with? And when she told him, he said, oh, he's like the ugliest guy in the village. You know what his sister said? Yes, but he's the smartest. Think about that and think about all of the engineers that India graduates every year. All of the Silicon Valley jobs in America that are filled by Indians. And think about the neighborhoods I grew up in and neighborhoods across this country to this very day. If you dare even show intelligence or being inquisitive, you can get beaten up.
Is that true still today?
It is sadly true in many places today.
And that's not just Harlem. Do you think that's true in many urban cities across America?
Absolutely.
We'll be back with more of this interview after this.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the reasons that we're having this conversation now is there was a day on America's News when we were talking about these dismal education scores. It was in Baltimore. It happened to be in Baltimore that day where there was not a single eighth grader in all of Baltimore public schools that could pass the math test. And we also know the reading scores are bad. A week later, we did something about Chicago. Same story. We asked the Chicago Public Schools for a statement. And the statement was, our numbers are in line with all the other major cities in America.
Right.
Like, this is not good. And the podcast is called Everything Will Be Okay, because I ultimately believe that it is true everything will be okay. But that's not a passive thing, that you have to take some action
right.
to make it that way.
Right.
So I'm a pretty optimistic person, but I don't want to say I'm pessimistic about what's happening in education across America, because there are some interesting things happening with school choice, et cetera. But if you are graduating year after year or losing kids because they don't even graduate, who cannot read and who cannot write and who cannot do basic math, their futures are horrific.
Right.
And it's a terrible cycle. And so we had you on to talk about it, and I thought it was just important to hear your thoughts as how bad is the problem and what we should be doing about it.
Yeah, the problem is without a doubt it is horrific, and it's horrific at the wrong time, right? As we enter the fourth industrial revolution, you know, before, for instance, in Alabama and South, you know, when my mom was younger, they had what they called the Great Migration, and it was blacks leaving the South to northern cities. And you can go to a place like Detroit, get a job at an assembly plant and make good money and buy a house and get your kids through college. And that was a way of taking a next generation higher. So even if you weren't necessarily a great reader or writer per se, or you weren't necessarily great at math, you know, there was a really pretty good stuff for you out there to do. And that's not necessarily as true anymore, right? I mean, as we bring in more robots and more things are done through computerization. So this is the wrong time for us not to have these sort of critical skills. And it is an emergency. It's a national emergency. I think it's probably this, along, I think, with the drug epidemic, are the two biggest emergencies in this country right now. In part because when you don't take care of them, the lasting legacy of them isn't just a couple of years, right? It could be a generation or two. So big part of the problem, too, is I hate to say it, but like these unionized schools where they mostly fight for teachers' pay, which is fine. I think, listen, I wish every occupation had a two-tiered payment system, part a base salary and part a commission based on excellence. This way, great teachers will get paid more. Great fire people will get paid more. Great folks at Starbucks will get paid more. You know, I really wish there was a way to do that, to incentivize greatness, right? I mean, we still spend more money in terms of nominal dollars than any other country. As a percentage of GDP and all this stuff, you can say, oh, well, Liechtenstein has more, you know. But, you know, realistically, as nominal dollars, we still spend more per pupil. A lot of that, though, does go to things that have nothing to do with education. Then it's the and then there's just this notion that the kids aren't up to the rigors of it. So from the very beginning, they're given watered-down curriculum, you know, watered-down.
You've written about this.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
The first time I kind of found out about this is when my son was in school. And, I'd always known about the achievement gap. And, of course, I saw firsthand when I came to New York that I was ahead of everyone in my class in school in Harlem. But I still hadn't put it together, per se, until I was a parent. And I was helping him with homework, and I was giving him tests. So I said, let me go online and Google and find some, you know, I looked up the textbook, and I would go find tests, either tests that were out there from the publisher or that schools had given, other schools across the country. And I soon discovered there were different tests for the same textbook. Mm-hmm. And some were very easy, some were really hard. And you have to say, wow, that's what's really happening. You know, that these kids are not being demanded of to excel. And unfortunately, I think a lot of parents bought into this because the kid will come home with straight A's and say, well, Johnny's on the honor roll. Yeah, he is, but he can't read. You know, and I think finally parents are now waking up to that. Initially they weren't hip to that, you know. So it's like, hey, did you hear about Johnny? Yeah, you know, the good news is he's on the honor roll. Bad news is he doesn't know what the hell he's doing, right?
And part of the reason that happens, as my former boss, 43, President Bush, would say, when he was governor, he would visit these schools, and he's like, wait, these kids can't do any of the work. And he called it the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Right, right.
So if you have low expectations, you will water things down.
Right.
And then some of these schools, like, they want to get these people out of their classrooms. So
yeah,
they'll give them the A,
yeah,
or they'll give them the graduation,
right,
and then that leads to a terrible situation.
Leads to a terrible situation. In fact, some of these kids are even, told they should go to college.
And then they take out loans.
Then they take out loans, and they drop out after a year. You know, they're not eligible for anything after that.
Wow.
They have that albatross around their neck forever.
Do you think that corporate America business leaders need to do more here?
Absolutely.
I do too.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because at this very moment, Jenny Rometty is out promoting her new book. And I tried to get her on my show. She said no.
Is that IBM?
Yeah. And the reason I mentioned her, she kind of coined a phrase, or she lifted a phrase, but you know how the person who probably came up with it, no one ever heard of. So it's now her phrase. And she says the future won't be about blue collar work or white collar work. It'll be about new collar work. So you don't need a 4-year degree, but you need more than a high school diploma. And so I think she's involved in this academy. I did a lot of research on her. So she's involved in some sort of academy, learning academy, and she's got a brand new book. You should get her for the podcast. I'm sure she'll come on.
I like her.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I do wonder, like, where's corporate America going to get the workers if none of the workers can do the jobs?
I gave it. Well, they've been getting it from overseas, right?
Yeah.
And plus, they get them cheaper. If you study the special immigration, classification for technology workers, and you see how much they earn versus native born, it's really a shame. Ironically, it's the Indian companies based in America who are underpaying them. You know, so the Infosys and those kind of companies. I've done an exhaustive study on that. There are four levels within tech that come over here. Only the top level, which is about 10%, are amazing. Are super duper, like the Michael Jordans of technology. The rest could be anybody in this country, in America right now, with a little bit of training. Those are jobs that we should have more Americans doing.
My brother-in-law teaches coding through a boot camp thing. It's a 3-month program. I think it's 3 months. It's connected through the University of Denver, but it's contracted. It's a private company that hires them. And I love hearing the success stories of the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker making a decision to maybe try something different. He's very good at what he does. And the way he talks about, let's say your salary as a truck driver is X, and then all of a sudden you're making 10 times X within a month of leaving this program. It's been pretty remarkable.
Yeah, yeah, it is remarkable. But
artificial intelligence is getting better at making the apps, right? You were teaching the AI to code.
Yeah, yeah. That's a whole different kettle of fish as well.
And it's getting us away from talking about this. I do wonder, do you think school choice is a good thing? Or is it also maybe hurting urban schools?
I don't think it's hurting our urban schools. I think it's a cop-out when they say that. And I was on the board of a charter school in the South Bronx for years. And And let me tell you, this is a very poor neighborhood in the South Bronx. And ironically, about 20% of the population are African, first generation African.
First generation. Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of them are settling there. And oh my God, if you just see when their kids, you know, we have to do the lottery thing because there's so many people who want their kids to go and there's only a certain amount of seats. When they win, the tears. And then the first day, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
The only thing is I would go volunteer. I would butcher everybody's name.
But they would know that. They would know.
It's so embarrassing. I'm like, Bagula Butla. Huh?
But at least you gave it a shot.
And then the thing would be like, no, that's Pete. It is? Oh, okay. Pete, get over here. Yeah.
My husband is British, and he was in the London office getting a passport renewal, and there were a lot of Africans there. This is in London. And he was waiting and waiting, patiently waiting. He was reading the Daily Telegraph, and he hears this, come on. Come on. His name is Peter McMahon. But the worker at the visa office was so used to trying to pronounce the African names
right.
Even like a simple name like McMahon, she got it wrong.
Yeah. No, so I think it's important. You know, I think competition is what drives us, you know. And again, it kind of gets back to an earlier part of our conversation where there should be a meritocracy attached to how much we earn and things like that. Even, you know, even if that was attached to schools, something like that might help. But, you know, the problem, though, Dana, is that these organizations, they're so embedded. They're so powerful.
The unions.
And the ideology, they go hand in hand, and they're extraordinarily powerful. And I really hate to say this, but, and you kind of talked about soft bigotry. You know, there's a term that you hear a lot these days, white supremacy. It is totally misplaced, totally misplaced. It's not some so-called redneck with an old pickup truck missing two teeth in Alabama. It's, I hate to say it, but it's in a lot of these skyscrapers in Manhattan where these liberals, you know, they donate to the Fresh Air Fund. They voted for Obama, but they would never hire a black person to do critical work. That's where the real white supremacy is in this country. And that's what's really holding back a lot of black people. Mm. But no one will ever talk about it. They will never admit it. And so, unfortunately, just like I think it's smart for businesses to create this pipeline of workers, potential workers. But it's really tough.
Was it you or someone else that I talked to that said that that corporate America should consider starting their own schools?
I have talked about that. You know, I just gave a speech about a month ago or so in Aruba.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Tell the story. Yeah. I love this story.
I was in Aruba, and it was there's a Christian money management firm with about 1,000 workers, 1,000 advisors. And what they do is they take their top 33 down to Aruba every year as a sort of a reward. And so I went and I spoke with them. And my favorite thing when I give speeches is the Q&A part, you know.
Me
so
too.
Afterwards, yeah. And so we're talking and, you know, it's and, you know, they kept bringing things up like, hey, you're the only black person in the room, you know, like, you know, how does it feel? And then one guy said, listen, honestly, Charles, and I said, I've been following you and I'm trying to figure this out because we've tried to find, you know, black workers or, you know, and we just can't. I said, you're not going to, not the way the system is designed. I said, but what you should consider is some sort of parallel, you know, training mechanism. And it's just not, for instance, for black people per se. This is for hungry people. There used to be a real famous executive on Wall Street. His name was Ace Greenberg. Ace Greenberg was absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. And his favorite thing, I'm going to paraphrase because I'm not going to get it exactly right, but he said the reason that they always beat everybody else on Wall Street, he didn't go for the Ivy Leaguers. He went for people who were hungry, young, and determined.
Do you know who else used to do that? Roger Ailes.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, I don't want the Ivy League students.
Right.
Give me the C student or the one from the Midwest, and they'll work harder.
Yeah. No, and he did that. He was like, you give me these people who really need it, who really want it, and they're starving, and they also are so appreciative of the opportunity, they're not going to blow it. So I think, you know, I think a lot of businesses, I think it would be smart, and I know, understand businesses kind of worry about, okay, I train someone, we put a certain amount of money into it, and then they go to my rival, that kind of thing. But I do believe, listen, one of the big things right now is a worker shortage.
Yeah.
At this very moment, the National Federation of Independent Businesses just reported this morning that it's the highest level of jobs, filling jobs, because of a lack of skills out there. And so it's an amazing opportunity. It's an amazing time. And it's a brilliant investment for this country.
Yep.
To hit the restart button.
How do you look at and talk to people about the role of the family here?
It's so critical. You know, that's why I kind of got a little with my mom, you know.
Yeah, of course.
If it wasn't for her and how she sacrificed everything, when she came up here, she sacrificed her own personal life.
Yep.
She was a warrior, but she was tough. I mean, I remember one summer she whooped my ass every day. And like we used to joke around, I'm telling you, me and my brothers would be in the house, I'd be hiding belts and stuff. Like I didn't know why she was whooping my ass. Like, why are you doing this? Stop. You know? And like, but when we first got to Harlem, we used to get beat up a lot, right? Mm. And then there was a guy named Andre who was like one of the ringleaders of all these people that picked on us because we sounded like white kids and we wore the wrong clothes. And I was just standing on the stoop one day, and here comes Andre by himself. He's kind of riding behind his bike, and I just said, oh, I'm going for it. I just ran across the street, and I just jumped on him. Bam! Swung a couple times. Andre ran. He left his bike. And I always tell people, if this was a Disney movie, the credits would have rolled after that. But it wasn't a Disney movie. Mm-hmm. So later on that evening, I don't know what happened, how it happened, but they got me. Right across the street from the house in a schoolyard. I'm surrounded about 12 people, and they beat me up pretty good. And one guy's choking the hell out of me, right? And I can kind of see in my building a blur coming out. My mother in her nightgown with a kitchen knife. Like, she was a warrior. Mm-hmm. She was a warrior. And she was so, so tough.
Did they scatter?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see this crazy woman coming out of my house. She's yeah. skinny and little, but yeah. she was going to.
Your mama was skinny and little.
Yeah. Yeah. She was going to, whatever she had to do to save me.
She's a mama bear.
Right.
Yeah.
And
these moms and dads across the country, they want the best for their children. Not just, I don't want it to sound like corporate America just wants the best for their children. If people have children, then they want the best for them. And our system is not giving them an opportunity to be their best. And it's, again, it's a little bit generational, especially if you have a situation where these kids are graduating without any skills and the chances of them ending up in jail are really high.
Sure. Well, Dana, to that point, you know, I hear a lot of people, you know, when this family issue comes up, and they'll, and they're sort of critical. Well, a lot of this is on the parents. The problem, though, is if the parent isn't educated, what exactly are they going to do?
Right.
They're going to help in kindergarten, first grade, third. What if fourth and fifth grader starts getting tough? They don't know the answer. They can emphasize education, but they really can't help Susie with the homework.
Nope.
So, you know, I think sometimes people are unrealistic when they say, hint or suggest that, oh, man, the community, the family, you know, it's not that at all. To your point, these moms would do anything. But first of all, a lot of them are working two jobs.
Exactly.
You know, and then when they get home, they don't have the time, they don't have the energy. And again, the threshold is low where they have they don't have the ability to answer the questions per se. Now, they can insist that you do it. My mother was no joke about that. Like, you are going to do this work. You know, like I said, I was lucky, though, that I did enjoy it.
Right.
You know, at least until we moved to Harlem. Then I was like, I don't know about this A student thing. Let me try some C's for a minute. You know, so that's another part of it that has to be addressed. How do we even kind of figure out a way to augment the great intentions of parents, particularly single moms, but who may not have the skill set to help?
And partly it could be more seats at the school at the South Bronx or more schools like that where they have the opportunity to change.
I have some ideas. I met with one of the Koch brothers about 10 years ago, and I pitched them on some ideas I had. They never called me back, but
I would have called you back.
More to come right after this. Charles, I've got just a few short questions.
Okay,
this is like a lightning round, and then we're going to get you back to your day job, which is a very important one, especially at the moment that we're dealing with these banks. Okay, you might have already answered this, but I'm going to go through it. How did you make your first dollar?
I think cleaning windows at stoplights. Yeah, Windex.
Who are your heroes?
My mom, my grandmother, my grandfather. In business, Reginald Lewis, Percy Sutton. There's so many of them, but my immediate family, really, they're always my heroes.
What is worth splurging on?
Watches.
Okay. Why?
For me, I just love them.
You love it.
They retain their value for a really nice watch.
One thing about you that everyone loves is you're a real individual.
Yeah.
And you stand out because you have great outfits. And tell me about the shoes.
Yeah, you know what? This is weird because I have an amazing shoe collection. But after the pandemic, you know, we all worked at home and I'm sitting in the flip-flops. I put on a pair of shoes. I felt like, you know, like somebody from Appalachia or something. You know, like, what the hell are these things?
Right.
They were hurting or whatnot.
For women, putting heels back on was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, so I got some sneakers. I said, I dig this look. So now I've got like 12 Prada sneakers, one for different colors for different suits.
We love it.
Yeah.
What question do you think every manager should ask in a job interview?
That's a great question. I think they should ask what someone's goals are sincerely, like not in a way like, hey, I don't, you know, even if it's to take my job, be honest with me, because I'll help you do that. Because ideally, if you're a great worker and you work so well that you can take my job, you'll bump me up as well.
Last one. How do you define success?
For me, success is the ability to help others.
Has that changed? Has your definition of success changed over the years?
Not really. You know, my being the oldest, I'll give you one quick story. I was in the Air Force, and when I went in the Air Force, my mom told me this story. I was in the Air Force. I was in basic. I just sent home almost my whole check, right? But before that, she had a job, but she was always minimum wage, and her and my brothers ran out of money. And she wasn't going to get paid for 2 days. And they didn't have anything. They had no food or nothing. And she says, you know, Charles always hides money around the house. That's the one thing I always did. Like I would put in albums or whatever. And they start looking around and they found 20 bucks in a jar and 20 bucks in an album, an Earth, Wind & Fire album. She says, you know, Charles, you saved us.
Yeah.
You saved us. Daddy, yeah. You saved us so many times. So
wow,
that to me is success.
The responsibility of being the oldest in your situation is one that shapes your character.
Yeah.
And that's how you are who you are. You get emotional about it because it meant so much to you and you knew what it meant to them.
Right.
And you would have done anything for them.
Anything. And I still do. Yeah. I've carried a lot of people my whole life.
Yeah.
I mean, I put them on my back and just carried them.
Good thing you have broad shoulders.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask one last one then. What is something people might be surprised to learn about you?
That I'm a pretty good artist.
Oh, tell me.
Pen and ink. I'm a pretty good pen and ink artist. So that's
really?
Although I don't draw as much as I used to. Yeah, but I'm pretty good.
Will you let us put something up when we promote this podcast?
I don't have most of the things I do I give away, but I do have something I did when the pandemic started. I'll find it and bring it in.
Or a photograph of it. That would be great.
Sounds good.
You know, it's good to have that artistic outlet.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm into art. I collect art anyway, yeah. So I love art.
You're an incredible human. Thanks for being here.
Thanks a lot.
We'll see how this goes. And I do think eventually everything will be okay, but you said it best. Our education problems are a national emergency, and we should act like it. And every one of these candidates who wants to be president should be able to articulate what they want to do how they're going to do it.
No sound bites.
No, we're over that. Charles, thanks.
Thank you.
There's a lot of wisdom in Charles Payne, and there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in this conversation. And what's wonderful is that since we talked, he and I have become even better friends. So that's a little bit about what this podcast does for me as well. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts. Leave a rating and review. I'm Dana Perino. Everything will be okay. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to Fox News Podcast shows ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or follow wherever you get your podcasts.